1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to touch base with somebody who's an insightful and favorite guest here on Hard Knock Radio. We're talking about educator, scholar, and now author Dave Stovall. And I wanted to check in on a couple of things. One, just to get an update on what has been happening in Chicago. We've been following, of course, a lot of things in Minneapolis, and people often forget Chicago, they just didn't leave and things went back to normal. There's a permanent presence. And one of the things that's emerged was the building in which people woke up and saw helicopters, Black Hawk helicopters and everything descending up on a building under the guise of trying to get gang members. Can you break down what the newest development is? Because now we're finding that this was kind of like a private army type of operation. This wasn't gang things. You told us like whatever gangs were there had left a long time ago. So why were they in this building on the south side?
Yeah. So, and again, thanks again for having me on the show. I think one of the things that really becomes important for your listeners is this actually happened early in the Operation Midway Blitz. And the idea was that the quote unquote gang from Venezuela, Trinidad Agua, was having a foothold in the neighborhood. And what really happened was that the city of Chicago brokered a deal with this particular apartment development that had some vacancies to house some Venezuelan migrants who had come up from by way of Texas. The owner of the building didn't want the migrants in the building as they switched ownership because there actually was a shift in ownership. So The new owners come in, they don't want them there. They contact ICE, say that Trinidad Agua is there and that they need some type of intervention. Greg Bovino saw it as a soft target, right? So you got folks in this space. You can do this shock and awe campaign, land a Black Hawk helicopter on top of the apartment complex, and then scoop out babies, elders, and whomever. Now, I think it's important to put in the context that the building had been in disrepair for about 3 years. They had, from the shift in ownership, they never did anything to repair the building and actually were forced to condemn the building and then sell it. But local reporting by way of the Sun-Times and WBEZ found out that the owner, hence post the sale, actually had reached out to law enforcement to telling them about what was happening in the building. And they lied on folks, right? There was no presence of Trinidad Agua. It was families and young folks. And they put them out in the street, zip tied them again for the shock and awe campaign for people to see it. And it was also in a Black neighborhood where Black families were also taken out and zip tied, falsely arrested, and then had to get themselves out. 3 months after that, a judge condemned the building. So All the families had to leave, but it was so fast that a lot of families didn't have places to go. So some people were housing insecure as a result of that condemnation of the building.
You know, what's interesting or what's problematic on a couple of fronts. One is that this was used almost like as an excuse to practice. Let's see if we can get these helicopters. This is a real life drill. So that's what appears to be happening. That's the first thing. Two, the ease in which these actions could be triggered. I wonder if Dave Stavall called up ICE and said, I have a problem in my neighborhood. And let's say it was the mafia that was there, or it was some other organized crime syndicate from Europe, which is extorting businesses, et cetera, et cetera. Would they have brought a Black Hawk helicopter, et cetera, to that neighborhood? So that's one, who gets to have those resources dedicated to, what should probably be just a local type of situation. It is for most of us, if we even get any sort of response. The second thing is coming back to it being in a Black neighborhood. We all saw those images. And even to this day, we have folks, especially in Chicago, that are walking around, organized, and at this point, we know well funded, saying this ain't our fight, and God bless ICE. And I'm just, that sort of imagery of Black families being tied up, and then folks immediately out there saying ICE is a good thing. How do we make sense of that?
Well, it's this thing. I mean, this is when this requires us to have a very explicit understanding of colonization, right? And what happens in a colony, right? So if there's a ruling body in a colony, then in order to maintain power, that ruling body who is outnumbered, they may have weapons, but they're outnumbered, they need to spark dissent among the people who are being oppressed. And this becomes critically important in a city like Chicago that's already hyper-segregated and has a history of denying Black communities resources. Now, what we don't talk about is that there are numerous communities that are being denied resources. It's not just Black folks, but in this particular practice of divide and conquer, you actually put out lies on the newest group, right? So when Venezuelan families came to Chicago, there was rumors that they were getting $9,000 a month, right? And we were all saying like, well, where is this coming from, right? But you have to have that disingenuous campaign to make sure that people are fired up. Now, there's another part to this, right? And it's one of these organizations that is mobilized. It's called Chicago Flips Red. And it's a organization primarily of Black folks who are supporting Greg Bovino and all of the particular spaces. And we have to actually look at the relationship to dark money when it comes to these spaces, right? And Dan Hosang, who's at Yale University, has kind of pulled this out to say, look, here's some organizations who have a funding source that's kind of hidden, right? When you start to look at their tax sources, these spaces, their funding sources are hidden. So at one point, there's actually funds distributed to this grouping of people, and then a smaller grouping of people who may have this dissent saying that Black folks are always on the outs when it comes to any type of infrastructure support. So it's important to put all three of these things in conversation with each other to understand the complexity. But that type, and it ebbs and flows. So Chicago Flips Red doesn't have as large a presence as it did when Operation Midway Blitz was at its height. They have positioned themselves as staunch opposition to Mayor Johnson. So it comes in these strange ebb and flows, but I think it's also important when we understand colonization and colonial powers actually pitting groups against each other to maintain power.
I want to come back to that. Dave Stavall is our guest out of Chicago. If you're just tuning in, colonization and how it operates. And I think this is incredibly important because it's playing out right now in real time in the US. So let's come back to this well-funded disinformation campaign. And if I understand correctly, one of the things that this country has practiced is going to another land that we have an interest in finding a small pocket of dissent, amplifying it and making us feel like this is the majority. We saw that in Cuba, right? So you bring some folks over and you say, look, they hate it there, and amplify that and give us the illusion that this is a majority thing. We saw this in Venezuela as well. We see this in this is not to diminish any sort of grievances that people have with their governments. It ranges. You may have legit grievances, and you may have grievances because you have been tyrannical and were replaced, right? So I say all this to note that there are debates within the Black community, for example, and it seems like these things have been amplified and played upon. So so in this case, you have the folks that are being amplified to flip Chicago red. But that dovetails into a nativist movement where you have foundational Black Americans and American descent, African American descendants of slaves, right? That takes this position that we don't want to mess with no immigrants. And you're going, where did this come from? And they're talking from Black immigrants to brown immigrants, right? And we know from the work that Jared Ball has done, and we've had him on, he talked about, initially, with Yvette Carvel, that she was being funded from these right-wing things, So that was already in flux. So I ask this because this disinformation campaign is so. What's the word I'm looking for? It's so well camouflaged, it's hard to tell because you can really have people latch on who have genuine feelings that align itself, but you got to question whether or not they are in the majority, how much impact they have. I know when this ADOS thing started was the fringe movement. It was like, yeah, okay, that's in the back corner. And then all of a sudden, it got watered and planted, but it wasn't because athletes and, and folks in our community were saying, let's fund this the way they might fund an NAACP. It was coming from the Steve Bannon folks. So I wanted to see your take, especially as an educator, the challenges and how we can really reconcile this disinformation, because disinformation is now made to seem like real information.
And I think it really becomes important when we talk about education to really backtrack and really understand the historical arc of disinformation campaigns, right? And this is a uniquely U.S. problem, right? In terms of the United States being so ahistorical. And because we don't really have a sense of history, everything that's put in front of our face becomes the thing that we accept. So now when we actually start to look at the history of these disinformation campaigns, you really start to see this emergence of a quote unquote, and we can call them that, a black right that has, and black right is very different from black conservatives, right? So that those are too, because there's a historical movement of black people who have, thought about rooting themselves in government and democratic process. And then another grouping of people that kind of emerge in the late 50s, that late 1950s, that consider themselves a part of that movement, but also as part of actually getting their support, blaming black certain sectors of black communities for their demise, right? So I think if we do that historical backtracking, it really becomes important. And that is an, I feel that that is a key tool in dismantling disinformation campaigns.
Well, but it seems like they're also starting to reach this disinformation at younger ages, right? And so I see, just from the work that people I'm close to and having kids, they're coming in with disinformation campaign with no history to back it up. So now you have people saying, don't call me African American. Huh? Like I can't, and where's this coming from? Like I ain't from Africa. I don't want to go to Africa. But you are 10 years old. Where is this coming from? And so, you in the classroom, how are you dealing with that? Because now if your curriculum is being dictated that you can't talk about Malcolm, you can't talk about Panthers, you can't even talk about Dr. King, you can't even tell people that the term African American was actually a black derived term in a political statement, right? Because now it's been flipped to have people think, oh, this is just some, term that has been levied on white folks. And people
Right.
listening might be like, oh, no, that ain't true. Start going to these schools and you'll see
Right.
where these kids are at. And, and they feel like they're riding, real hard, or they'll dismiss some historical figures, Like I just seen something where they were talking about W.E.D. Du Bois and, like he did a good thing getting rid of these foreigners, talking about Marcus Garvey, not realizing W.E.D. Du Bois' history
Right.
of
Right.
being a
Yeah.
Pan-Africanist.
Right. I think it's critically important, again, to think about, because you have to think about it in certain spaces, right? So if you are in hostile states, now you have to think about what's the fugitive way for you to kind of introduce those areas, right? And now you have to do a little bit of
And
two
when you say
things.
future, when you say hostile states, meaning they're just places you can't even talk about this.
Right. They're
You will get you,
places
yeah, you'll get
where you can
fired.
be arrested. If you mention it, right? So if you're in Florida, if you were in Texas, you can be arrested depending on how they decide to enforce it. So now you have to think about, well, what are the fugitive ways, the ways that are kind of in between that are not using the language that's banned, but also actually being responsible to history, right? So for example, when you talk about disinformation, well, what's the history of disinformation? And what examples do we actually see of disinformation? Now, how do we take into account our beliefs? Where do they emanate from? How was this informed? Where did we get this information? Why do we feel as if it is true? And now, is there a conflation of what we think to be true and what we actually know in the actual world? And now, how do we wrestle with that contradiction? So I think it's really important, instead of kind of backing away from it, but to say, all right, there's some things here, right? And now, how are we talking about these things in relationship to what we see in the current moment, right? So now it's kind of with some of the stuff that you do, right? So instead of put away your phones, no, take out your phones, right? Let's put this, let's put this in conversation, right? Let's start to think about how this stuff is communicated, right? And then we can even have that discussion. And I'm thinking about the 10-year-old. We can have that discussion. If they got a phone in front of them, like, well, let's have a conversation about algorithms, right? And how they even work, right? So this thing around really using it. As an educator, you have to use all of these opportunities as teaching moments, but also as teachable moments, but also spaces where you can start to rethink the possibility of being able to think about what's happening historically.
Is that too complex at a time when people are used to just quick sound bites and easily digestible, situations and scenarios? It's
I would
easy
say,
to go ahead.
yeah, I would say no, because you can use what's in front of us and now just break that down, right? So again, the 10-year-old with the phone, right? What apps do you use, right? Now, how do you get stuff that you didn't type up that's now sent to you? What mechanism operates there, right? So now you can use whatever's in front of you to ask those critical questions, right? So I think it's it may feel daunting, especially if you're in those states that have this high persecutory power around content. But this thing around really being, it requires us to be nimble in terms of how we're communicating and getting young folks to engage and think.
I wanted to ask you, Dave Stavall, this set of questions. And now I want to dovetail into, the article that you had sent me a while ago, from The Guardian. And it was situated in a study that was done for the Center of Ethics and Rule of Law, CEU. RL. And what they were talking about were these studies that they have done, you know, these what's the word I'm looking for? You know, these they ran a group of studies, right?
Right,
To
simulations.
simulations. Thank you. Couldn't think of the word to say what would bring about a civil war. And it seems like we're on path. And they were looking at Minneapolis and the killings that took place, et cetera, et cetera. And what intrigued me is like we're looking at that, we're seeing all this play out in real time. But I wanted to come back to you first because of where you're situated. We can't forget what's went on in LA. We can't forget what's gone on in Chicago. Yeah, two people were killed in Minneapolis, but you had another 30 that were killed all around these other places. You know, two people were shot in the eye and blinded in Minneapolis, but we also had them in other places. And to your point about history, we almost forgot that there was this stuff going on in LA and it's still going on. We almost forgot that this was going on in Chicago and how dramatic it was. Nobody's talking about that. Now it's all on Minneapolis. And then once they move to Ohio or wherever there's a large group of Haitians, we may actually forget of what's going on, but the seeds for civil war are there. And it seems like one side is gearing up in every way possible, and there's no opposition to even think about, you know, what can be scaled up, what can be done in case. I mean, it's ranging from snatching ballots for the elections to talking about nationalizing the elections to, you know, developing a police force to show up at all the polls. And I'll conclude with this: people forget, you know, this amnesia. People forget what was sparking off in Ferguson. You know, it wasn't just Mike Brown, but they were like 24,000 warrants for 22,000 people who live in a city. And you're like, and how would they enforce these warrants? Because, you know, people got these warrants from other cities when they would drive through, and they were frivolous warrants that would show up at the voting booth. It's like, we're just going to sit here and wait for Dave to come down and vote. And so these were practice runs for something that can be very real. And we don't even have we're not even talking historically, recent history to kind of put it in motion.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was most telling about the center out of University of Pennsylvania when they ran those simulations, the review committee was all active military. And to me,
Wow.
that stuck out because the military affirmed it. The military affirmed and said, no, we feel as if these scenarios are real and we have situations where they can happen, right? So to me, where militaries often serve in service of government, for them to look at a scenario and say, oh, this is possible. That to me lets folks know that this situation is a little more plausible and more folks are concerned about it because the military now has to make the decision as to whether or not they will obey a non-constitutional order. Right. And the military, in their review of the scenarios, said, you know, this is something that we have to contend with, but we are very aware that this is a possibility. I mean, they use language that wouldn't spark fear, but at the same time, they said, look, we reviewed this. This is not far-fetched, right? This is something that we feel can be activated in certain ways. So it was, and that alarm to the center at UPenn said, this is a little different because usually the military will just review the scenarios, write a report up. But the thing that stuck out was that they said, this is quite plausible, right? And
And a lot of that is conflicting orders and
exactly.
conflicting loyalties. So, and we haven't, and see, I want to ask about in Chicago. Here you have a very outspoken mayor, somebody who, you know, With elected with the grassroots organization. He's not shy. He hasn't bit his tongue, right? And he might say to the police, stand down. He might say to the police, protect these citizens. And that creates this constitutional, well, I won't know if it's constitutional crisis, but definitely a crisis of loyalty, right? We'll have Chicago police stepped in to stop ICE. We saw that in Los Angeles, the sheriff said, I don't care what they saying, we are not going, we're going to wear a mask. No, they said they're not going to enforce a mask mandate. So, but the mayor just ordered you to do that. Well, I'm telling you that we're not. Oh, wow. Okay, who's going to enforce them at this point? And I don't know when you have a strong mayor like Johnson in Chicago, has he run up against that? We've seen the acquiescing in Minneapolis. Yeah, some people have said that, but then I turn around the next day and they're mass arresting people, right? So there seems to be confusion or maybe alignment under the guise of quote unquote being confused. Like, I'm confused, Dave, but I'm just going to follow the orders of the military and federal officials, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems like it's going to come a point where rubber's going to meet the road and a hard decision's going to have to be made.
Yeah, without question. And in Chicago, I think it's important to note that the vast majority of your white police officers are Trump supporters, right? That's been so when we look at the two districts, we look at the two districts that actually voting districts that voted for Trump in 2016 and 2024. Those are districts that are heavily populated by police, right? So one being Jefferson Park, the other one being Mount Greenwood. So we know that your white police officers are Trump supporters. So that's not an overarching statement. That's a statement in relationship to the data that's actually been mined over the last two elections that Trump won. So now you can see those scenarios where there's a halt and say, they say, well, look, I'm confused. There is a space, I mean, all the way down to the district level that says, look, the police department is in service of the mayor, right? It's not in service of the state or any federal body. We have some federal responsibilities, but it's actually in service to the mayor. But now, if they want to pull that, you know, if leadership wants to pull that and say, particularly the FOP with a guy named John Cataranza, who says, look,
Fraternal Order of Police.
yeah, and he says, look, we can, this is not constitutional. So we're advising all of our officers to stand down if there's any command given by the mayor. Now, that
By
puts,
the mayor.
yeah.
So if the mayor says this, he's telling the troops
He
to
could
stand down.
go in that direction to say, you know, you don't that we feel as if that's unconstitutional and we'll stand down. So you have a number of different directions. You have the city, the state, and the federal government. So now those three spaces causes deep confusion in terms of where loyalties are and to where chain of command operates from, right? So now when you think about these paramilitary organizations, which are police forces, now they have to figure out, well, where is the chain of command and how do they respond given this usurping of the chain of command to where one point of the chain is in opposition to the other. So again, a different scenario that could be extremely chaotic when you think about any type of enforcement.
As you're talking, Dave, I'm thinking about the dissatisfaction many communities have had when the fight had been, let us get a black police chief. We get a black police chief. They, in theory, should understand what black folks are going through, and therefore they will come there and turn things around. And we saw time and time again that didn't work. That the chief is, yeah, they're beholden to the mayor, but can't control the union, the Fraternal Order of Police, right? Where it was really glaring, well, we've seen that time and time again. Pick a city with black police chief, and you still have, these things going on. You get a black mayor, or a progressive mayor. We've seen that not work either. I'm just thinking about De Blasio, when he was in New York and police were like turning their backs to him and refusing to work, et cetera, et cetera, and then protecting themselves with the union. And even now with Zohran Mamdani, many people have said, I could quit before I work for you. So those type of things. And now the different calculation is, hey, if you don't like the progressive DA that may try to prosecute you for doing wrong, and there were 40 of them, one of them in Chicago that was elected, or I don't like this mayor that wants police reform, join ICE. Come to ICE. And now you have a president saying, I'll give you complete immunity. So now we have folks who may have stayed and said, oh, I know that person who went to ICE. He was a problem here on the force. Does that set up a civil war
I mean,
or a civil conflict type of situation?
to your point, I mean, it's even kicked up in terms of celluloid imagery, right? So during Operation Midway Blitz, ICE used to run commercials in Chicago, right? So they ran commercials where they gave you loan forgiveness, a $50,000 signing bonus, and Trump later on in relationship to Minneapolis and Chicago and New Orleans and then down in Memphis. Were saying that they had immunity, right? And then states pushed back on that. But remember, they said, well, look, I mean, and in the advertisements, they were very specific. They said, look, in the state of Illinois, your government does not respect you. So they're speaking to white cops. Your government does not respect you. Here's a place where you can do the work of your government. And now be properly compensated, right? I mean, they're straightforward with this space. And now those commercials are run nationally, right? So they play them during, sporting events or what have you. So it's this full-on attack to say, look, if you're not feeling your police force, we got a spot for you and we will compensate you, right? At a level higher than what you currently make. So this thing around putting the material realities in it in terms of economic gains if folks join ICE. So again, they've heightened the piece. It's no longer just rhetorical.
Have there been any studies to see how many cops have left the force, taken that bite, and gone, with ICE,
Yeah,
at least in Chicago?
there's some preliminary stuff, but no. Real hard data sets yet, but I think there's some people who are working on it. Yep.
What do you think the average person should do at this point in time? Should somebody like you join the police force? Should you
Right.
join ICE? When I was in Texas, there's like long lines of brown folks who
Right.
joined ICE,
Right.
I
No.
mean, but it's almost like a poor person's
Right. Exactly.
situation. It's like, hey man, got a $100,000 loan from school. They're not going to repay it back. They just caught off all, I used to be able to teach in the inner city. And work that off. They cut that off. I used to be able to do community work for a nonprofit. Can't do that no more. But $100,000. Let me join ICE, get that $50,000 bonus. And I never liked these people anyway across the way. And boom, you have incentive, you have compensation, as you pointed out, and you have a recipe for disaster because there's a lot of other folks that are sitting there going, what do I do? Do you fill
Right.
the void? Do you join yourself or what?
Right. Yeah. I think, well, first, answer your question. Do I join ICE? No. But this thing around putting it in the larger conversation, because this is an old piece that we need to understand about policing, right? So, police jobs are one of the few spaces where you don't have to have a 4-year college degree and you are compensated with a living wage. Now, the other contradiction is you are also awarded lethal power, right? So this thing around really putting that in context. So now, if you think about who has been deemed the enemy, once you enter police forces, you are now trained to accost that enemy, right? And you are given provisions to make sure if there is any question about your actions, you are protected before you are persecuted, right? So, I mean, I think when we understand police forces, these contradictions, the material contradictions of economic reality, but also this idea you are trained to accost that enemy, right? People of color, immigrants, poor folks, right?
Right.
Folks who may have, who may struggle with addiction, right? Anything that is deemed to be the dirge, your responsibility is to rid the municipality of them, right? So now, I mean, as a structure and function of policing, right? It's not
Right.
protection first. It is actually protection for the rich and the removal of those things that impede on the wishes of the rich. So I think it's really important to kind of put those contradictions in play because there are folks who may have that sentiment where they never really liked the folks in the first place, but there are other folks who are like, man, I'm $150,000 in debt, and here's this thing that's going to pay it out front. I can stick with it for a couple of years and maybe figure something out. But what we see is that policing does not work that way.
We are seeing, to your point about protecting the rich, ICE moving in that direction. And again, I come back to that, the developer, having his building become, a practice session. I'm calling it a practice session where they ran drills with, and arrested people in the whole nine, right? So now you have two layers. Police were doing this and, protecting the rich and property. And now ICE is doing that as well under the guise of eradicating, quote unquote, illegal immigrants, right? So now, where does that leave the average person? And I'm asking this because Chicago has long been an organized city. Chicago, has made history. You're one of the first to put a progressive DA in place, right? You all have rough and tumble politics for a very long time, and you also had the sharp contradictions of rough and tumble politics internally, but a strong mayor that could, hold it down before Johnson. I'm even talking about how the Daley machine might have been perceived. Nobody wanted to mess with the Daley machine, whether they was federal or whatever. They understood they had to kiss the ring, right? So you always had that sort of situation, and you're wondering if that sort of scenario stands up to the assaults that, we see encroaching on us every day. And what does the average person like yourself and others start to do?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things that come off in terms of what does the every what is the person doing the everyday, right? I think
Right.
one of the things is to pay attention, right? So
Okay.
anything we see, we need to ask critical questions of, and we really need to be able to follow that trajectory of how that argument has come into play. Second thing, if we know and are concerned about what could happen to people, then who are the people in our respective locales who are doing their doing that work to support them, and how do we actively support them? The third thing is to be very intentional about interrupting the conversation that is rooted in disinformation. And there are three very simple questions around interrupting that information. One is, where did you get that from? Two, do you see any actual evidence of that in the in your everyday? And three, well, who are the people who will be harmed if this false information gets out to the wrong people, right? So I think those things, and because that's something that's all that's rooted in criticality, but it's also rooted in care to say, look, I'm not here to put myself as some oppositional force to you. I'm not, I know you. We grew up together.
Right.
We live together, right? We have broken bread, but I am deeply concerned because when that misinformation hits certain folks, there's the greater chance that more people get harmed in opposed to support it, right? So it's keeping the issues and concerns at this very tertiary level to say, these are the questions that I have. And now, given my concerns, this is where I'm willing to take the conversation.
So it sounds like the homework that concerned people need to do is really do deep dives in searches to find the information, because I think I forget how much it might be, 1.2 billion. Maybe I'm wrong. I got to remember the figure, but it's a considerable amount of money that has been set aside just for influencers on the web. And with that money comes the dressing up and a sophistication. So, to give people an example, what I'm starting to see, and I monitor a lot of this, are feeds with now a person who is just kind of in his basement is now sitting in a news studio. I don't know if it's AI generated. I don't know if they got a nice backdrop. I don't know if somebody came along and gave them some money and they actually are. But now you're sitting there with a suit and tie in a news studio and you're sitting there, hey, Bad Bunny couldn't speak Spanish. I mean, he only spoke Spanish, and this is bad for the black community. And you're like, what? And you're sitting there and you have the bells and whistles. Was that a newscast that I saw it on? And you have to look and then look it up and be like, man, this dude just got online like last year. So who are you? Where did you come from? Why are you even on my feed? I didn't ask to follow you, but there you are. And then I'm seeing you right there on the top on the Explore page on IT, and you're being recommended on YouTube, right? And so the average person's not going to know to do that. They're just going to think this might be a CNN, AP Wire type of, like you have legitimacy at this point. And that becomes confusing. So when you ask that question, it's like, brother, I just got it off of the internet. Where on the internet? There's a newscast. What newscast? It was the Sundown Reporter newscast. Oh, Sun. Chicago Sun, Sundown. Okay, makes sense. And here it is, guy with a suit and tie, but spitting venom. And that's where the disinformation is now sophisticated. And a lot of people, I don't got time for all that. I just know it's on my feed. It's showing up right next to the CNN report. So it's legitimized.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, and one of the things I've been telling my students for the last 30 years, right? Take nothing for face value, right? Absolutely nothing. Right. And if we just have that as a practice, then we can at least ask a different set of questions, right? So now anything you see, right? If it is quote unquote from legitimate sources, right? Okay, well, what informs that? Right. So now what, and now that I'm not taking this thing for face value, what am I contrasting it with? Right. So now where are we starting to think about the possibility here? And then to what extent does misinformation have the capacity to harm folks, right? So really thinking about that, because everybody knows a situation where there was a misunderstanding, a miscommunique that just evolved into something else that became highly problematic. So now it's really around doing that in terms of the digital world.
And I would also remind people, as that's happening, there's been a delegitimizing. Harvard is whack. It's disinformation. All these universities are disinformation centers, is how it's being depicted. So now you have somebody who feels that their opinion and their speculation trumps, no pun intended, your 20 some odd years of scholarly work and on the ground, study for a particular topic. And then you get gaslit and go, well, the guy in the barbershop, he gets to have a say. So who is you? Who is you, Dave Stavall? What makes you more important? I'm on the ground. I'm on, the old, I'm in the streets. I guess it makes sense when I think and see Mark Lamont Hill now go to some of those podcasts that have a space, because you could easily be written off. Oh, you're just one of them college folks. No, I'm actually sitting next to the source of information that you now depend upon. And maybe, and so this leaves me with our last question. Do people have to strategically infiltrate and be a part of these situations? The inside outside strategy. Do you join a police department? Do you go into ICE? And I'm asking this very seriously because everybody else is. And at one point, gangs were going into some of these forces, at least the army, the military. So do we have to ingratiate herself, or is there a hard line in the sand and you build up your own forces and see if you can attract, as many bees as they do to the honeypot?
Right. I think you have to be guided by a moral compass. There's always room for inside outside work. But in the organizing, that inside outside work has to be paired. In a lot of situations, people will do inside work, but never have groupings of people. They'll go in with good purposes, but they don't have a group of people that they're accountable to. So now you have to think about what are those inside outside strategies, and then what is the pairing of those inside outside strategies in terms of now if we got somebody on the inside, what are we doing to communicate with folks on the outside? I do not recommend that for any paramilitary or military bodies because we see how dangerous it can be for folks who are thought to be infiltrators. But I think in government there's room for that. But if you have that inside strategy, you must be accountable to folks on the outside. The pairing of those strategies is critically important if you're going to use them.
Otherwise, you get caught up. You
Exactly.
have to debrief. You got to be reminded, like,
Yep.
you're
All the time.
here because, you're for the community, not for the people that you break bread with.
Yep.
Dave Stavall, I appreciate you taking time out this afternoon and joining us, sharing us your wisdom. How can people follow your work and, and any last comments or marching orders for our audience?
Yeah, definitely. I'm at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I am in the Department of Black Studies, and I'm also in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Justice. I just had a book that came out that talks about some of the stuff that we talked about on the show called Engineered Conflict, Structural Violence, and the Future of Black Life in Chicago. So if folks,
So it just came out.
it came out about a month ago. Well, actually a little less than a month ago, about 3 weeks ago. So if anybody is interested, check it out. Hopefully it's a decent read for folk.
Okay, well, there you have it. The name of the book again.
Engineered Conflict, Structural Violence, and the Future of Black Life in Chicago.
There you have it. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan, Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else is just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't gone all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they ready from the steel gray beef. Say please, maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, I need with a piece. Made a some shade on your name in the street.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast. Dance out.
My friends, I want to welcome all of you from the W.E.B. Du Bois Abolitionist School. And I invite you to hear my words about the late great revolutionary, Dr. Frantz Fanon, the gift of Fanon. When we think of, or even speak of, the great Algerian revolutionary, Dr. Frantz Fanon, the word gift doesn't immediately come to mind. But upon reflection on his immense contributions to the anti-colonialist struggles, perhaps that word, gift, will reemerge. Fanon, although born in the Caribbean island of Martinique, made global impact with his masterwork, the book, The Wretched of the Earth. In it, he wrote powerful truths about the Algerian struggle for liberation from the French Empire and the continuing struggle for African freedom and liberation from colonialism. If Anand provides any gifts for us, I think these that follow are soul food for the freedom struggles of today. First, his riveting message about the nature of colonialism, which is, of course, a present war, but also a war against history itself. Fanon wrote, and I quote, "Colonialism is not satisfied with snaring the people in the net or of draining the colonized brain of any form or substance. With a kind of perverted logic, it turns its attention to the past of the colonized people and distorts it, disfigures it, and destroys it." Fanon. Why does the colonizer destroy the people's history? Simple. Destroy the past, and you destroy the present. This gives you some sense of the power and value and worth of history. Here is his second gift, his message to the young people. Again, we turn to the pages of The Wretched of the Earth, where he writes, "Each generation must discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it in relative opacity." The question becomes, for each generation, what is your mission? Will you fulfill it or betray it? The words of the revolutionary thinker and worker, Dr. Frantz Fanon, with Love Not Fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.